Is anybody here who was not here who wants their exam? Last name?
I was reading it upside down.
And who else? I have, I think, one artist left on the New Negro Movement. So I'm wondering if you have any questions that have come up about it. I mean, I think that the film is going to really make a lot of things clear for you. Armand, can I see you at a certain point? Yeah. And I mean, really, the message that I sort of have behind it is this idea of a group of people who share a philosophy, who share a political stance, who work together and all knew each other, but in fact never shared a style, and whose work stylistically falls into a lot of different categories, but because they're African American, they're usually marginalized. And I was thinking about that last night. I was thinking, well, Judith, you just did that. You lectured on them all together. So I think next time around, I'm going to put at least Lois Mayu Jones' Les Fétiches, at least that painting, in with 1930s Paris. Because that's, you know, and when you see the Wilfredo Lam lecture, you'll also, I mean, I can... It's easier for students and for teachers if you group all the artists together as single individuals, but it's not as creative. Yeah?
The Schoenberg Library, you said it was on 35th Street.
Right.
Was it 125th Street?
No, 125th Street is the Studio Museum in Harlem.
Oh, okay.
And I'm pretty sure it's 135th. I've been there.
Okay.
There's a hospital and a parking lot.
Okay.
No, 125th Street is sort of, you know, the main avenue of Harlem, but that's not where that branch library is. About, okay, warm up. About what we're doing.
Here we go.
Fleur? It's just, isn't that the one I showed you, the still life?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was the only, I think it was the, here again I lost it.
Is it the input?
Huh?
Is the input right?
No. And my little cursor. What did you tell me to do to find the cursor last time this happened? What? Yeah, it's off my screens. Oh, there it is. I found it. So I really was, I'm going to quickly go ahead here. I really was using the Palmer Hayden and the other still life with the two masks, right, to show you just how different Lois Mayu Jones was, right? Just to, and again, sort of to emphasize my bigger issue of that these artists were all looking at African art, but they all used it differently. So that's why I how did that happen? So we're sorry about this. There he is. But as long as you're looking at it. So this is Fétiche Fleur, and this was Marvin Gray Johnson, Negro Masks. So it really was just for comparative purposes. And Jacob Lawrence. Here we go. So Jacob Lawrence was born in 1917 and died in the year 2000. He began painting in the 1930s at the age of about 17. And he became, and I think this is probably correct, just about the most popular African-American artist of the 20th century. He has garnered enormous respect. And there have been many, many museum shows and publications on his work. He was involved in Harlem during the period of the 1930s with Augustus Savage and the Harlem Studio Workshop. He studied directly under Savage as a young man, so her politics influenced his way of thinking. And I'll show you. Here he is when he was a, obviously in the independent one-person show at MoMA in New York City. So this is, you know, very early on that you have an African-American artist having a one-person exhibition. Here he is teaching to students in New York City. He made a living in the beginning by teaching. He was, again, this sort of the Augustus Savage influence of working with the community, working with students in the community, and he's actually teaching them the series that I have chosen to teach you about, which is the Toussaint Louverture series, and he's talking to them, looking for my little laser light thing, right, about it. So you will actually be seeing this series in my lecture today. I would like to, okay, so this, would like to say that during the 1930s, if you are taking a more broader course in African American culture, you would realize that African Americans rediscovered aspects of the history of the Americas and incorporated that history into their own lives, their own work, etc. If there's anybody in the class who's from the theater department, you might know about the incredible productions that were done by plays with all black casts that did Shakespeare. Then they recreated Shakespearean tales to fit into the history of Jamaica or the history of Haiti. It was a very, very exciting period. Here you see the group with the group called the 306 Group, and most of the important African-American artists that we've been studying were in this group. It's just to give you an idea. They 306 West 141st Street, again in Harlem, was Charles Alston's studio. You don't have to memorize this. But they, again, just to show you that they grouped together to discuss issues. It was a very vibrant intellectual community that was happening. And here we have Jacob Lawrence at in 1939 at an exhibition opening. You will notice that he is the African American and everybody else is Anglo American, and you'll hear about that more in the film. But I did already talk to you a bit about the Harmon Society that has, and the film brings up the controversies about the Harmon Society and their exhibitions. And now I want to go straight to the one series that I'm going to be teaching you. It is on all the influences come together in this Toussaint Louverture series. Toussaint, done 1937-38. This is a lithograph of the actual human being named Toussaint Louverture. It's not your fault. It's the fault of our educational system, but I just have to backtrack a minute now, because you probably don't even know how to spell it. Is it in the study guide?
Yeah.
Thank you. Phew. So, did you want to? You can take a guess.
Does he have to do with Haiti?
He sure has to do with Haiti.
So he has to do with the Haitian Revolution.
And he absolutely has to do with the Haitian Revolution. So, okay, that's all you know. So I lectured about this in my other class, but very briefly, Haiti had a revolution that was inspired by the French Revolution, by the storming of the barracks, the thing you all know about from Western civ courses, right? And the slaves of Haiti, who were French subjects, because Haiti at that point was called Saint-Domingue and it was owned by France, heard about this revolution and said, excuse me, if we're subjects of France and there's been a successful revolution in France, we should have one here too. Right? We should be free too. And it led to this incredible revolution. Toussaint Louverture was one of the generals in charge of the population in Saint-Domingue. The Haitian Revolution is usually dated approximately 1794 to 1804. And Toussaint Louverture was captured, taken to France, and died, who was the military leader and political leader of France, Bonaparte Napoleon. So the slaves and free blacks of Haiti beat Napoleon's army, and I always say the world has never forgiven them, because Haiti is still the poorest country in the what is called the New World. And you all know about the kind of deprecating language that is always used about Haiti. So one of the goals in the New Negro Movement was to find out more about Haiti and to use Haitian material in theater productions, in art, to go to Haiti, to paint in Haiti. Haiti became sort of iconically so important in the New Negro Movement. So very early in his career, Jacob Lawrence chose to do a series based on the life of Toussaint Louverture, okay? And I'm going to show you, so this is Toussaint right here, and this is Jacob Lawrence opening of the series, okay? 1937 to 38. These are very, very small paintings done on Masonite. He was a poor, this is in the 30s, right? He was a very poor artist at this point. So here you see, and what I'm going to show you, and they really are small, the original. They've been reproduced, blown up, you know, made offset. No, please. I just am too nervous. You could move to the other side of the room. I'm sorry. I just don't want the video not to work. So, do you recognize this man? Napoleon. I mean, I was going to say, yeah, you can't recognize Toussaint because you never learned about him, but you can recognize Napoleon. So I'm just sort of going to show you a quarter of this whole series, and they're stunning. I've seen the originals, and they're very small. And they're on, you know, heavy masonite. So here we have, as a child, Toussaint heard planters whip and saw blood from the bodies of slaves. So each of the series has a text to go with it. So it's a very didactic series that he went around and taught school children, et cetera, et cetera. The cruelty of planters led the slaves to revolt. Toussaint captured Marmalade, held by, okay, doesn't matter, but Marmalade is one of the most important plantations in northern Haiti that was the site of some of the most gruesome battles of the Haitian Revolution. So this is Toussaint with his troops capturing the plantation Marmalade. Okay? General Louverture confers with his principal aides. Jacob Lawrence not only is embodying a fresh look at history and a new way of acquiring subject matter, but he's also experimenting stylistically with a style he feels appropriate to the subject matter. There is an influence here from murals, and you'll get that when we get to the mural lecture in the class also. This is a stunning one. You can buy a poster of this one. General Louverture collected forces at Marmalade, October 9th, 1794. Okay? So this is certainly reminiscent. Do you all know, have you had Western art history, Marcel Duchamp's Nude Descending the Staircase? Some of you, right, but think of how different this is. I mean, think of the purpose of it is so different, right? The meaning of it is so different. But yet you can see that Jacob Lawrence looked at textbooks. He knew art history, and he took those lessons seriously. He doesn't have a degree from any school, okay? There's also the use of the silhouette in these, which is from African-American popular culture. And remember when I was introducing this, I said that Alain Locke said that it was very important to also look at popular culture. Sort of black vernacular culture, so you hear the use of the silhouette is part of that vocabulary. If any of you are going to be in New York over Thanksgiving, rush, run to the Whitney Museum to see the Kara Walker huge one-woman show, contemporary African-American artist. Huh? And that was it. Okay. So I had to show you that little bit, and now I have to redo the whole thing to get the film going. So, let me load up the film quickly. Are there any questions? Yeah.
The artists that weren't mentioned in the study guide?
If I didn't mention them, put a line through them, cross them out. What? Sure.
Helen Griffiths Harmon, the founder's daughter, bestows the honors. It's a gold medal and painting for Palmer Hayden, the former janitor who traded in his mop and pail for a brush and palette. Congratulations, Palmer.
I showed you one.
If you missed the big opening in the Big Apple, don't worry. Soon these artworks will hit the road, as the Harmon shows do every year, traveling to all 48 states. It's a dream come true for these talented colored artists, and hats off to the Harmon Foundation for helping deserving Negroes to help themselves.
Struggling against considerable odds. America was a segregated society. Blacks were expected to scrub floors and open doors, not paint and sculpt. Universities and art schools were reluctant to accept African Americans. And if they did get in, when they got out, there was no place to go. Blacks were almost totally excluded from the world of museums and galleries, where they might be able to show and sell their work. That's where the William E. Harmon Foundation came in. For more than a decade, the Harmon Foundation's program of exhibitions, prizes, and scholarships for Negroes provided an opportunity, just about the only opportunity, for very few people at the time were paying much attention to black artists. So the Harmon Foundation became a kind of cottage industry. By default, the reigning authority on African-American art. The foundation was dissolved in 1967. Many of the artists it had discovered and nurtured were forgotten, along with their work, until the Newark Museum brought together, for the first time in half a century, more than 130 paintings, prints, photographs, and sculptures by Harmon Foundation artists.
One of the exciting things about this project was the detective research that was necessary to find work by artists that we simply had exhibition catalogs of and titles of paintings and sculpture, but had never really seen the work and had no idea what had happened.
We called one artist, a family, and talked about it. They said, well, we just, you know, this was
1993. Film was made.
And so we looked at this as a point in art history that hasn't gotten very much investigation or serious scholarship. The research and the scholarship we did in the exhibition.
Demonstrates through these extraordinary pieces that blacks had a lot of things on their minds as artists in the 1920s and 30s, at a time in which the country was, for the most part, prepared to only hear harken back to Africa. They were able to create works that had to do with black folk culture, had to do with cosmopolitan black life, had to do with the whole question of miscegenation. In other words, these artists suggested that blacks were able to speak in several tongues in a society that historically had encouraged them to speak in one voice, and that is the voice of the American Negro, either a victimized voice or a voice which was so contented that it had no depth or elevation.
The images of the American Negro that were created by Negro artists were complex, subtle, and human. A radical departure from the way blacks were usually portrayed as bug-eyed minstrels, shuffling darkies, sly mammies, and watermelon-loving pygmies. Stereotypes that were firmly fixed in the national consciousness. W. Griffith's 1915 epic celebration of the birth of the Ku Klux Klan effectively rewrote the history of the Reconstruction period. In Griffith's version, blacks were the villains, and for most Americans, those flickering images became the reality.
I think that if you look at the impact of the birth of a nation, which really struck the country, it was regarded not only as a cinematic masterpiece, but also as a sense, sort of ideological masterpiece.
Very important scholar.
The superiority of the white race and the imminent threat of the black race to the white race. This was not an idle sport. This was not some accident, some lunatic theory on the part of the Hollywood producer and director, but in fact it reflected the mainstream of scientific thought at the time about the relative position of the two major races in the United States. So-called science was essentially highly racist almost by definition at the turn of the century and down into the 20s. Book after book from highly regarded authorities and exceptionally well received, proclaimed the division of races attributed characteristics to different races and almost inevitably put blacks at the bottom of the racial heap. Blacks were depicted virtually everywhere, and certainly that was part and parcel of the official thinking as posing a tremendous threat to the integrity, to the moral health and educational well-being of the nation. And the conflict between the two races was seen as
lynching parties terrorized the countryside and worked their way northward as legal protections were steadily rolled back. With career options limited to menial labor or sharecropping, grinding poverty became a way of life. The best hope was escape, and between 1900 and 1918, over a million Southern blacks packed up and went north, more than doubling the African American population in the North and the Midwest. It was known as the Great Migration.
This was a period in which this country received hundreds of thousands of European immigrants, Jews and Italians and Poles and Lithuanians and Greeks and Irish and Germans. And these people came to this country, and within the same moment of history that blacks were sliding, if you will, backward, they are moving forward, creating the impression that blacks were not up to snuff as a people.
But when World War I broke out, blacks had a chance to move forward. Northern factories recruited African Americans to fill the well-paying jobs left open by whites who had gone overseas as soldiers. Eventually, blacks were allowed to join up too. In segregated companies, 200,000 African American soldiers were given an equal opportunity to die for their country. The war that promised to make the world safe for democracy did not create full democracy for black doughboys when they returned. Nevertheless, they proved themselves to be disciplined, valiant servicemen. They came home war heroes. And the triumphant successfully fought tyranny in Europe were a lot less willing to tolerate racial oppression at home. In the summer of 1919, whites instigated race riots in Washington, St. Louis, Houston, and Chicago. And this time, blacks fought back. And they got organized politically through the Urban League and the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, headed by W.E.B. Du Bois. Du Bois and his colleagues decided their most urgent task was to improve the image of the American Negro, and they needed artists to fight on the front lines. In the early 1920s, a sweeping public relations campaign was launched to paint a new picture of the African American. It was called the New Negro Movement, and the New Negro was first and foremost an artistic creation composed of stories, poems, songs, and pictures that emphasized the virtues of the race. Civil rights.
I suppose what's extraordinary about the Harlem Renaissance and Empire is it's in a sense artificiality, that you are really creating an arts movement out of whole cloth. You're taking people who, in the normal course of their professional lives, have become lawyers, businessmen, morticians, teachers, and you're saying that, look, we perceive that you've got something that could be parlayed into an artistic expression, paint, voice, indeed, clearly the instinct of the writer. And the fact that a small group of civil rights notables, people around the NAACP and the Urban League, programmatically set out to divert many people from their professional tracks into the arts is what is fascinating. Straight away, Charles Johnson, the editor of Opportunity Magazine, the mouthpiece of the National Urban League, reached out for Aaron Douglas, who was then a teacher of art in the city, and inveigled him into coming to Harlem. simply because Johnson knew there had to be a plastic artist.
Adam Douglas's murals at the New York Public Library's Harlem Branch set the tone for a neighborhood that had become both a coveted address and a state of mind. Negro culture was all the rage, and Harlem was the Negro capital of America. Its library became a star-studded literary salon that the uptown intelligentsia would meet regularly to hear County Cullen recite a new sonnet or debate an essay from the latest issue of Crisis Magazine, Strivers Row and Sugar Hill. Society matrons hosted private music acts and poetry readings. And for the less strenuously high-minded, there was the night. White and black, rich and poor alike, got on board Duke Ellington's A-train, lured in by what Blue Nose is referred to as jungle music. Harlem locals could choose from an abundance of cabarets, dance halls, and rent parties, but the most famous and lucrative nightclubs catered to white audiences, with blacks providing the exotic entertainment. In fact, white money and white audiences were essential ingredients to the Renaissance. Harlem had become a huge manufacturer of art, and the care and feeding of its artistic production line was more than the black community could handle alone. So black leaders were eager to form alliances with progressive, wealthy whites who were sympathetic to their cause. White patrons came from all walks of life, but they all came with an agenda. They supplied cash and demanded art in a kind of benevolent censorship. The writer Zora Neale Hurston called them Negrotarians.
That pungent, handy phrase characterized a motley crew of Millendale whites, and they ranged from those who were simply furious and wanted to pleasure themselves in Harlem and attend an occasional cocktail party, and that was as far as it went with them. And the confluence of it with socialist energies in society.
William Elmer Harlan was no socialist. He was a dyed-in-the-wool capitalist, the creator of the suburban subdivision. Born in 1862 in Lebanon, Ohio, Harlan owned real estate firms in Ohio, Massachusetts, and New York, and in 1900 alone, bought more than $4 million worth of property in Brooklyn. In 1922, he established his philanthropic foundation, which built playgrounds, trained nurses, and handed out awards for constructive achievement among Negroes. Harmon thought that encouraging blacks to be financially self-sufficient would help the country in general by getting them into the economic system at however low level. His annual achievement awards for Negroes were divided into 8 categories: business and industry, science and invention, music, education, religious service, race relations, and fine arts. Each winner received a gold medal and $400. The social philosopher George Haynes, who headed the Commission on Race Relations of the Federal Council of Churches, was recruited to administer the foundation's prizes for Negroes.
The Harmon Foundation, William Harmon in particular, and I think many of those who were involved in the foundation, black and whites, were driven by a quintessentially American form of racism. And we need to study this. How has it been possible? Harmon was paternalistic toward blacks. He suspected that blacks were inferior, but thought that blacks would become a better group of people if given help by people or individuals of his stature. He was also shaped by the notion of civility, that black people should be treated in a civil way by whites of the North. And what all of that means is that despite his subtle racial antipathies, he was prepared to help blacks. The key issue is that the blacks who were the recipients of his benevolence understood the arrangement. They understood his paternalism. And despite, or in face of it, you know, against the odds of that kind of racism, these women and men were in control of what was important to them aesthetically.
A Only 12 artists applied to the Harmon Foundation's first competition in 1926. The gold medal went to Palmer Hayden, who had been supporting himself as a janitor. The press latched onto that juicy tidbit, and when Hayden decided to take his prize money and go study in France, the headlines trumpeted, "House cleaner quits scrub bucket to paint abroad." Hayden came back to the States in 1933 and eventually became a kind of spokesman for the foundation, making public appearances and starring in the promotional films. He did many of the watercolors that were in subsequent Harmon shows. Woodruff's and Hayden's prize-winning paintings were displayed in the foundation's Wall Street headquarters for 4 days for a few hundred invited guests. The next year, 41 artists applied for the Fine Arts Award, enough for a real exhibition. 87 works were selected for a show at the International House on Manhattan's Upper West Side, close to Harlem, but not close enough to scare away any potential white visitors. By 1928, the year William Harmon died, the Foundation's Negro art exhibits were part of its public identity. There were national tours, and similar exhibits sprang up in other cities.
They weren't interested in promoting one particular style or a particular kind of art. Basically, what the foundation said to artists was, we want to help show your work, we want to help sell your work so you can improve your lot in life. And that was really basically what it was all about. It wasn't about aesthetics.
If the Harmon Foundation lacked an aesthetic vision, it certainly knew how to draw a crowd. 150,000 people saw the 1931 show, which had to be moved to larger galleries in Midtown. The opening ceremonies were filmed, and an elaborate catalog was printed, with an essay entitled "The African Legacy and the Negro Artist" by Elaine Locke. Locke's influence over the Harlem Renaissance was second only to that of W.E.B. Du Bois. Locke was from the black aristocracy, 5 generations of old Philadelphia Africans. Educated in an integrated high school, Phi Beta Kappa at Harvard, and then on to Oxford.
He went furthest, I think, in the direction of championing the idea of freedom of the arts. He went much further, I think, than Du Bois, who insisted basically on a literature of racial uplift, believing very strongly that a novel should advance the cause of the race in some by portraying blacks in a very positive light by structuring a drama where, say, the young black reader would be led to believe in the race and take steps towards improving himself and improving the race. I think Locke's attitude was a lot more flexible and a lot more art-oriented, but still at its very core, he too saw art, the practice of art, as being somehow tied intimately into the political and cultural future of the race. He believed that blacks, by their paintings, by their poems, the novels, and so on, could express the whatever it was, that central gift, that geist, that spirit, that was at the core of the national being, by the national, I mean the black national being, and that in that way, the race would identify itself and then build on that self-identification to mature as a race. And I know that to think of the race as needing to mature is debatable, but I think that really does represent what Locke believed.
Locke thought that art by African Americans should look different from art by white people. Black artists should look to Africa for inspiration. Johnson was another of Locke's favorite sons. Johnson had been orphaned as a young
Oakland,
boy and
California.
Reared by his aunt, the
I
sculptor May Howe Jackson.
Talk about him,
critics always mentioned Johnson's.
He has a fabulous piece at MoMA, San Francisco.
Clean, round forms to pre-Columbian art.
That one. You can see it.
Locke also liked the paintings of Malvin Gray Johnson. Johnson was scraping by as a menial laborer when he was discovered by the Harmon Foundation and quickly became an art world sensation. He died young, though, in 1935, in the midst of preparing his first one-man show. The Harmon Foundation mounted the exhibit anyway, and the reviews were enviable. Alain Locke and his disciples believed the African connection held the key to creating a new kind of visual art in this country. European modernists like Picasso and Matisse had already discovered Africa and were using primitive motifs and tribal forms in their work. If Picasso and Matisse thought African art was worth imitating, it had to be taken seriously by the white establishment. And Bach reasoned, no one had a more legitimate claim to the African heritage than the African American.
Well, maybe another contemporary artist said it maybe best. Noah Edwards is a contemporary sculptor, and it says he doesn't know why people go on and on and on about the fact that are looking for things that are black in his work or African in his work, because he is African. And so in the same way that you would find things that are European in a Euro-American's work, you will find things that are African.
An African past. Many of them had lived and studied in Europe and were comfortable with that aesthetic. What's more, in Europe, Blacks didn't have to limit themselves to Negro art exhibits and even colored-only cafes. And some black artists simply didn't feel connected to Africa.
Du Bois, of course, has talked about this in The Souls of Black Folk, when he talks about the divided souls of the average black American. On one hand, you have the African soul, and the other, you have the American, or I say even the European soul, and how they're contending for this body and tearing the body apart, except for some superhuman effort on the part of the individual to pull the two sides, his or her two sides together, Africa and Europe, or Africa and white America, if you like. That was, of course, a central problem psychologically and artistically, culturally, for blacks who participated in the Harlem Renaissance.
William Edward Scott, whose soul was decidedly more European, was a master of the kind of artwork that new Negro philosophers like Alain Locke were eager to leave behind. Scott was older than most of the Harmon Foundation artists and had built a respectable career for himself in France, showing regularly at Paris exhibitions and getting good reviews from the French critics. Nevertheless, I was invited to help judge the annual competitions, and over the years, she became part of the foundation's inner circle. Alan Freelon is another unrepentant traditionalist. He was more interested in solving technical problems of light and color than in changing the world. Nearly all of Freelon's paintings were thought to be lost until the Newark Museum tracked down Freelon's son in the phone book. It was the first time anyone had seen the work or even asked about it since his father died. Freelon was strongly committed to the new Negro movement, but he disagreed just as strongly with Alain Locke about mining the African past. He wrote that, quote, "The American Negro has no more actual knowledge of his tribal background and jungle ways than has the Anglo-American of ancient Druidic rites." Freelon was afraid that art by African Americans would be ghettoized into its own separate but unequal category. And he wanted to be judged as an individual. Lassane Wells won Harmon Foundation medals in 1930 and 1933. He had some success with commercial galleries in the early 20s, despite the unspoken whites-only policy. but he quickly learned that while it was possible to make a reputation as a printmaker, he would have to make a living as a teacher. The year before the stock market crashed, he accepted an offer to join the faculty of Howard University in Washington, D.C., where he remained for more than 40 years.
I didn't have a problem with African sculpture in my early work and later in teaching. I tried to encourage my students to look carefully at African art and African sculpture, but becoming interested in other things that were taking place.
And things like that. And so I thought in my naive way that, well, you hear so much about the question, social question, that the individual is lost in the midst of the discussion. So I thought I'd just go make documentaries of people, black people, since they lived amongst them, to show them ordinary people.
Alan Cripe grew up in Boston and studied at the Boston Museum School of Fine Arts. His specialty was the genre painting, scenes of everyday life. Cripe has won lots of awards over the years, but very few of his works were ever sold. He supported himself as a furniture designer and draftsman, and eventually donated his entire collection to the Boston Athenaeum. Lois Maylou Jones, another Bostonian, also attended the Boston Museum School and later joined her colleague James Wells in the Howard University Art Department. She was working as a textile designer when she entered her first Harmon Foundation show.
The textiles had names, Grobret, Bisbee, and had beautiful names, but you never saw Lois Maylou Jones. And I made up my mind that I wanted to go down in history, in art, and to do that, I'd have to paint. Having gone to the Boston Museum School, and had the exposure of the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, where I would go and look at the works of Sargent, and Winslow Homer, and Aspire, more or less in that direction. I wasn't thinking at that time of any particular racial boundary, you know, limit. So that it really was sort of wide open. But I must say the Harmon exhibits did sort of change you into working to be popular.
Popular, but not required. Pragmatic to the end, the Harmon Foundation was not governed by any kind of artistic philosophy. They relied on outside experts, hired guns, to choose the art in their annual exhibits. The Harmon juries were usually made up of a handful of established white painters and at least one black, resulting in a mishmash of different styles and levels of quality. Some thought the diversity was exhilarating. Others complained that diversity was a euphemism for anything goes. Even Aaron Douglas, who was one of the Foundation's favorites, criticized what he called the vacuum cleaner approach to art. He wrote, "Neither streets, houses, nor public institutions escaped. When unsuspecting Negroes were found with a brush in their hands, they were immediately hauled away and held up for interpretation. They were given places of honor and bowed to."
I showed you this photograph.
Every
that's Schomburg.
To protest their innocence was drowned out with big mouth praise. A number escaped and returned to a more reasonable existence. Many fell in with the game and went along making hollow and meaningless gestures with brush and palette. But the Negro artists have emerged. The emergence of the Negro artists provided fresh meat for the critics, but gave scholars a brand new subject to study. All his work, but they always referred to him as a Negro artist, who showed in all black shows. In fact, most critics, both black and white, had difficulty seeing beyond the color of the artist. Whites especially tended to describe art by African Americans in well-intentioned racial cliches.
In the 1920s and 30s, ethnic identity, or religious or racial identity, was very important. But the African American artists, I think, had more trouble with that. They were just considered too exotic and too other. And in the art world, African-American artists were associated with color, with excitement, with that kind of joy, and you were expected to paint that way rather than in any abstract way or cerebral way or geometric way. that would belong, say, to the School of Paris, to which you really didn't belong, because that was just not your heritage. And in the 1920s, when so many of the hyphenated Americans were rediscovering their roots or not wanting to lose their roots, critics enjoyed very much wanting artists to paint from their roots. And in reviews of exhibitions of African-American artists, the critics asked for more African-American experiences, that somehow this would be a contribution to the larger whole of American art, that the African-American artists should not imitate American artists. But they didn't quite know what to say about these artists, and so they fell back on the stereotypes that they knew, that African artists had rhythm. And in painting, you don't necessarily find an African rhythm or an African-American rhythm. But they would speak about the joy of life that they found in African-American painting. So this was a spirit of them at all.
And there was this assumption that one would buy a heart shaft or a marked suit and then jump on the back of a crocodile and go off in the jungle. And that one simply had to be patient with that kind of condescension. But it was hoped that, given the interest of the Harmon Foundation, given the prizes annually awarded and the rest of it, those opportunities would in fact finally transcend what was a kind of hostaging of creativity to stereotypes.
But the difference between a stereotype and an archetype is often in the eye of the beholder. Honest, unsanitized depictions of African-American life made some black readers nervous. They wanted positive images, upstanding role models, or at least sympathetic characterizations, like Archibald Motley's popular painting, Mending Socks. When Motley's work became less sentimental and more stylized, the anxiety level at the NAACP rose a notch or two, even though Motley's later work is his best. Archibald Motley was simply doing what all real artists do, finding his own voice, just as the real writers of the Harlem Renaissance were doing. Langston Hughes was one of the first to declare his artistic independence from his readers and from his patrons. Oh, be respectable. Write about nice people. Show how good we are, said Negroes. Be stereotyped. Don't go too far. We know we are beautiful and ugly, too. The tom-tom cries and the tom-tom laughs. If colored people are pleased, we are glad. If they are not, their displeasure doesn't matter either. We build our temples for tomorrow, strong as we know how, and we stand on top of the mountain, free within ourselves.
Some blacks were acting out the role of the so-called happy darky because this was part of the expectation of the audience, and what the white audience expected of blacks. Other blacks did something that in some respects was equally dangerous, which is because they became so prim, so proper, so righteous and self-righteous that they were acting out, they were playing another role that was equally false in a way. People like Hughes and Hurston, I think, both tried to find a middle ground, which was to recognize that as far as they were concerned, there was a kind of exuberance to black life that could not, should not be lost, and yet still, blacks had a certain kind of responsibility to the race, to the nation as a whole, and therefore had to be also sober. The struggle was to find the middle ground. It was always, I think it was perilous for almost everyone concerned.
The struggle for that middle ground was in many respects a class struggle within the black community. For most African Americans, higher education meant trade school, and those lucky enough to go to college were rarely encouraged to study something as impractical as art.
Moreover, by the 1920s and 30s, painting and sculpture had become dominated by major institutions connected to white wealth. That is to say, it was several classes removed from black people, and spiritually and emotionally speaking, also removed. So it may be that black visual artists and white visual artists who documented black life empathetically were not as well understood as jazz musicians or writers or choreographers or dancers who
who were just, if you will, a step, if you get the metaphoric thing, a step separated from what black people could do if they wanted to.
Most African Americans in the 1920s and 30s were more concerned about supporting their families than supporting the arts. But there was a substantial and influential black bourgeoisie who shared the same values, aspirations, and even affectations of the white middle class. They did care about art and literature and being a credit to the race. W.E.B. Du Bois called them the talented ten, the primary gene pool of the Harlem Renaissance.
It was elitist, and the notion is a trickle-down notion, which mirrored the notion in America of social progress. It's trickle-down. The wealthy make things better for us if we don't tax them out of existence. And it wasn't hypocrisy. And Pullman porters and sharecroppers.
I graduated in 27. I hadn't gone that far, really, in painting, so that it was a matter of doing the textile designs and then thinking of a position. And I went back to the Boston Museum School and talked to the director, Henry Hunt Clark, about perhaps having an assistantship or some such thing. And he said, Lois, we don't have any opening here, but have you ever thought of going south to help your people? And that was really a shock, because there I was, this young woman in Boston with friends at Radcliffe and Simmons College and Harvard and all, and telling me to go down south. All I knew about the south was Tuskegee and Fisk, and sort of looked down a little bit on sending me down there.
But Lois did go south, to Sedalia, North Carolina, teach at Palmer Memorial Institute.
I had been willed $1,000 by an elderly couple in Rhode Island, a black couple who realized that I had talent. And I told my mother that I thought it would be wonderful to drive down to North Carolina. And so I went and got this very snappy little gray car. It should have a big headlight. And that was the funny thing, of having a big stem and a great big headlight put on the car. And then there was one of those horns with on the side, you know, that was to be put on for this long trip down south. And it was quite a thrill to go out and paint in the backwoods all around here. I had never seen Negro cabins. And some of the first paintings that were exhibited by me in the Harlem exhibits were of those cabins.
The Harlem Foundation was delighted to show Lois May Lou Jones's Southern cabins, but nobody was particularly eager to buy them. The watercolor remains in the artist's own collection, as does much of her work. In fact, very few of the Harmon Foundation artists were ever able to make a living by their art alone. Many turned to teaching to supplement their income, but not everyone was as fortunate as Lois Jones. Augusta Savage started her own school for aspiring young artists in Harlem. Through it, she became one of the most influential forces in the new Negro movement. Civil rights activists made her a cause célèbre when the Fountain Blue School of Fine Arts accepted and then denied her admission because she was black. John Wesley Hardwick won a Harmon Medal in 1927. That one prize, unfortunately, proved to be the highlight of his career. He kept at it, though, turning out landscapes and portraits and even a few murals for churches and high schools in his hometown of Indianapolis. But for the most part, he lived in artistic obscurity, eking out a living as a manual laborer. Elizabeth Prophet also spent the last years in poverty. She was one of the most famous visual artists of the Harlem Renaissance, having been discovered by W.E.B. Du Bois in Paris, where she moved in 1922 to attend the École des Beaux-Arts. The French critics adored her elegant austerity, and she was regularly included in the big Paris exhibitions. She returned to the States in 1930 to collect the Harman Foundation's award in sculpture, marking the beginning of a decade-long prize-winning streak. She joined the faculty at Spelman College, but gradually dropped out of sight and disappeared altogether after her last show in 1945. When she died, friends had to take up a collection to keep her from going to a pauper's grave. Those are the kind of tragedies the Harman Foundation tried desperately to prevent. Their primary goal was to help black artists become financially self-sufficient, and that meant making sales. Racial expression was fine, as long as it didn't get in the way of moving the merchandise. And over time, the annual awards exhibitions came to resemble high-pressure sales showrooms.
I said all the works were for sale, and they wanted to help bring artists into the marketplace for American art, black American artists, to bring them into the marketplace. They had been almost completely, over the years, excluded from the marketplace. They tried to help artists get gallery exhibitions, and they all lived inside these works could be bought and collected. And because of that, they had to realize that the bulk of patrons throughout this country were still white, and that if they were patron works that had a very strong racial overtone, that most whites were not going to be interested in buying. So there was a lot of tempering. I mean, the foundation and even other social philosophers like Dr. George Haynes, who helped run this program for the Harvard Foundation through the Better Council of Churches, who was a very influential philosopher about social change in this country, said that he really felt that black artists should not necessarily look to African roots or racial expression in the work, because he felt that if they do that, if they did that at this time, they would never be able to enter the larger mainstream of American culture.
But it didn't seem to matter whether black artists made primitive sculptures or impressionist watercolors. Nothing sold. William Henry Johnson was one of the foundation's stars. As a young man, he landed a one-man show in Paris, picked up a Harman Gold Medal in 1929, and returned to Europe for an 8-year sojourn in Denmark, where he married a Danish woman. Johnson continued to send his paintings back to America. The Harman Foundation was left with more than 1,000 of his unsold works, which were eventually donated to the National Museum of Art in Washington. Had the Harman Foundation not stepped in, there might be nothing left at all of Johnson's work.
I think that it's extremely short-sighted, in my opinion, to come down too hard on the patrons of the art renaissance. Artists have always needed patrons. We continue to need patrons, artists and academics, anyone who wants to do something a little bit different, something that requires an infusion of money from some basically non-official source. That's an inescapable part of the production of art and scholarship. In some instances, it backfired because certainly patronage has its dangers. But by and large, if you look at the patronage extended by the Harman Foundation, then I think you have to say that it was of enormous service to the Renaissance.
I don't think the Harman Foundation was as blameworthy as its critics have said. The commercializing of the art was inevitable, and that's a rather standard sort of phenomenon, isn't it? The thing gets going, and the people who really have a talent will somehow survive the institutionalization of it, and it will be seen that they really are good, and the best ones continue to have a career long after the Harman Foundation was simply of interest to historians.
The Harman Foundation mounted its last juried show in 1933. But it continued to support black artists through modest educational programs and occasional small exhibitions. The foundation's director, the formidable Miss Mary Beattie, permanent art collections to the Harman Foundation's arm twisting. But any renaissance, by definition, has a beginning, middle, and end. The beginning of the end of the Harlem Renaissance came with the Wall Street crash of 1929, although its effects were not immediately felt up in Harlem. But by the mid-30s, the robust fortunes that had financed the movement were starting to wither in the grip of the Great Depression, and Harlem began to deteriorate as a community. The riot of 1935 brought the era to a dispiriting end.
By 1935, when you have that riot taking place, you understand that something it has happened. A dream has died, the dream that brought the people from the South to the great city, and with expectations of a new life, of prosperity, settled prosperity, that has died, and that it died, the Harlem Renaissance. But the great thing about the Renaissance is that it leaves behind works of art that continue to work. And that's exactly what happened. The Renaissance lived on in its power.
The difference between the era of the Harmon Foundation artists and our own is striking. Before the modern civil rights movement, before World War II, people had a narrow view of human potential. We simply did not see those links within the human family. So these women and men are struggling against...
So just before you go, I just want to make a comment. Now you understand why standing, and also brings up the problematics of the entire situation. So have a nice weekend. Okay, you can see me at 12 o'clock. I have a class that starts at 12:30. Okay.
No,
okay. Come find me.
Okay, that's your tip.
I can't believe it.
I got seriously.